blue sign hurtles through space toward a green planet. Turner. Now, a logo of a thick-maned lion framed by a ring of film, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Now, in a black-and-white film, a brick embankment slopes upward toward industrial buildings in the distance. A title appears, The Asphalt Jungle, a John Huston production, copyright 1950. This program has been described by the Media Access Group at WGBH with funding from the U.S. Department of Education. Described by Justin Saul and Christopher Flowers. Read by Miles Neff. For more about description, call DVS at 1-800-333-1203 or visit our website, access.wgbh.org. Starring Sterling Hayden as Dix Handley, Louis Calhern as Alonzo D. Emmerich, with Gene Hagen, James Whitmore, Sam Jaffe, John McIntyre, Mark Lawrence, Barry Kelly. Screenplay by Ben Matto and John Huston from a novel by W.R. Burnett. Director of Photography, Harold Rosson, ASC. Art Directors, Cedric Gibbons and Randall Duell. Music by Miklos Rosa, directed by John Huston. A police car cruises the deserted inner city streets. Elsewhere, a man in a dark suit and fedora walks along a row of columns between two sets of railroad tracks. The police car passes on the street behind him. The man ducks behind a column. Seeing the car disappear down the road, the man continues walking. Meanwhile, the police car passes under a dense web of power lines.
Attention, car 71. Hold up, Hotel de Paris, Camden Square South. Hold up, Hotel de Paris. Armed suspect, tall man, Caucasian, wearing a dark suit and soft hat.
Square 71, roger.
The car does a U-turn and speeds back down the road. Meanwhile, the man in the dark suit walks down an alley. He emerges across from a dirty white brick building. An unlit neon sign reads Cafe. The words American food are painted on one wall of the building and home cooking on the other. The man enters. Inside, a flat-topped chef looks up at him as he takes a seat at the counter. The customer hands off a pistol to the chef, who turns to the cash register, revealing a hump on his back. He opens the register, drops the pistol onto a stack of bills, and closes it back up. He then glances out the front door and turns a dial on his radio. Two uniformed police officers enter. One immediately frisks the customer as the other faces the chef.
Gus! Gus! What time does punk come in here?
Don't ask me. I don't watch the clock. I own the joint.
No gun. I'll search the joint.
You got a warrant.
Now look, Gus, why don't you cooperate?
Get a warrant.
Take him in.
On what?
We'll book him on bay.
All right, come on, you.
The customer casually leaves a tip on the counter.
Come on.
The officers lead him away. Gus turns a dial on his radio. Now at a police station, the man in the dark suit walks with two shorter men into a lineup booth. Men and women sit at rows of desks, watching them. A cop reads a file.
Smith, Carl N., age 37. Arrested 6 p.m. last night. Phone police station stating he had murdered Mrs. Catherine Smith. Doldy, William, age 22. Possession narcotics. Occupation clerk. No previous record. Attempt suicide last night with necktie. Handley. William Tuttle. Alias Dix Handley. Age 36. Born Kentucky. Occupation none. Arrested 1937. Illegal possession firearm. Sentence 1-5. Escaped state prison. 1939. Arrested 1940. Released 1941.
That's enough.
A portly detective turns to a bald man.
Well, do you see the man who pulled the stick up last night?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
He had a hat on.
Put on your hats.
The three suspects comply. The detective faces the bald man again.
Well?
The bald man swallows.
He was tall, you say. He had on a brown suit and a wide brim hat. All right, don't you see him?
The bald man studies the face of Dix, the tallest suspect. Dix gives him a cold stare.
Well, come on, is that him?
The bald man shakes his head sheepishly.
No, it isn't him.
The portly detective sneers. A mild grin creeps across Dix's unshaven face. The bald man avoids his gaze and fixes his tie.
Okay. That's all.
The bald man quickly leaves. A uniformed officer approaches the detective.
Lieutenant Diedrich,
what is it?
The commissioner wants to see you in his office right away.
The officer leaves. Later in the commissioner's office, Lieutenant Diedrich stands in front of a desk holding his hat. He nervously runs his fingers over the brim. On the other side of the desk, a big-eared, white-haired man in glasses sits reading a report.
Sit down, Lieutenant.
Thank you, sir.
Diedrich timidly takes a seat. The commissioner sets down the report and folds his hands.
39 thefts, 33 burglaries, 18 robberies, 7 assaults, 5 morals offenses in the past 30 days. Quite a record even for the 4th Precinct, Lieutenant Diedrich.
We know the guy who's been pulling most of the stick-ups, Commissioner. Name's Dix Hanley. He was in the show-up this morning, but our witness got cold feet and backed down. What can you do?
Knock up the witness. Scare him worse. It's your job knowing what to do. As things are, the only merchants safe from harm in your precinct are those who take wages on the horses. I want to know why those parlors are still operating.
I close them down, but they only open up again.
You don't close them hard enough. Rip out the phones. Smash up the furniture.
People like to bet the horses, sir, and just because the law says no.
I don't want your opinion of the law.
The commissioner returns to his seat, puts his glasses back on, and picks up the report. Diedrich leans forward tentatively.
Is that all, sir?
No, that's not all.
A photo shows a middle-aged man.
Where's Irwin Riedenschneider?
Oh, I'm waiting to hear on that, sir.
You don't know where he is, do you?
No, sir, but we ought to get word from our stoolies.
It was all dumped in your lap. He left state prison yesterday at 12 noon, took a train for this city, time of arrival 3:17. All you had to do was spot him, stay with him for 24 hours. If he didn't register, lock him up. What happens? He loses you 5 blocks from the depot, and one of the most dangerous criminals alive is now at large in this city.
The 2 men in that detail ought to get medals for dumbness.
They were assigned by you. You ought to get one, too. Diedrich, I can do 3 things about you. I can reduce you to the rank of patrolman and send you down to 5 corners. I can bring you up for departmental trial on charges of incompetence, or I can give you one more chance to make good on your responsibilities. I think that'll be the greatest punishment of all.
Thank you, sir.
Diedrich stands, smiling. Nighttime. A taxi drives down a grimy, poorly lit street and pulls up beside a multi-story building. Its top floors are cloaked in darkness. The driver faces the back seat.
There's the number you're looking for, but it's dark. You want me to wait?
A man's torso can be seen through the passenger side window as he hands the driver his fare.
I wouldn't go parading around this neighborhood with a suitcase. Some of these young punks might clip you just to get a clean shirt.
The passenger turns away as the taxi drives off. He carries his suitcase to a dirty wooden door and presses a buzzer. A shade briefly rises on the other side of a window. The door opens a crack.
Yeah?
I want to see Copy.
Who are you?
Just say Doc is here and would like to see him.
The burly doorman unlatches a chain lock and lets him into a dark hallway. Light spills in from an open window over a door. Doc takes several paces forward, then sets down his suitcase. The doorman brushes past him.
Wait here. You better be on the legit, pal.
He steps through a door at the end of the hall, then shuts it behind him. Doc steps toward it, then turns. As he paces across the hall, light spills on his face. It's Irwin Riedenschneider. A trim mustache adorns his lined face, and a derby sits atop his head. He turns back toward the door at the end of the hall.
Well, where the devil is he?
A man with a pencil-thin mustache approaches Doc.
All right, make it fast. I'm busy, man. What do you want?
I just got out today.
Oh, so that's it. I'm getting tired of you guys that fell putting a bite on me. I'm no First National Bank.
I got a proposition for you.
All you guys are.
Maybe you didn't get who I was.
I never seen you before. Come on, what is it?
Maybe you've heard of me, the professor, or Herr Doctor, maybe.
Cobby sizes him up.
You mean you were Riedenschneider?
Doc gives a little bow.
Well, why didn't you say so?
Cobby waves him forward.
Come on in, Doc. Come on in.
Doc follows him into a dingy office filled with tables and desks.
Sit down, Doc. Sit down.
Doc sets down his suitcase.
Have a drink?
Nothing to drink.
Cobby opens a desk drawer.
I got out of the habit behind the walls.
Cobby pours some liquor into a glass.
That's all it is, a habit.
Well, here's to the drink habit. The only one I got that don't get me into trouble.
He sips his drink, then sits on top of the desk.
Well, Doc, what's on your mind?
I got a proposition. A big one. How big is big? Too big for you, Copy.
No, wait, Doc. I don't like to brag, but I'm doing all right. Making book. I'm in the chips.
He moves behind the desk.
What kind of proposition is it?
A plan for the keeper, and it's a good one. I could sell it for $100,000 on the open market, but that would be throwing money away. I prefer to execute it myself and make...
How much?
$500,000.
Copy sits slack-jawed.
Maybe even more.
The bookie finishes off his drink.
Of course, I will have to do a little checking, as the plan is some years old. But not much checking, not much. I need awfully $50,000 to operate.
Copy cricks his neck.
$50,000?
Doc gives a curt nod.
I don't see.
Of course. I thought maybe Mr. Emmerich.
What do you know about Mr. Emmerich?
Only what I heard in the balls. That he has money to invest, and that the way to get to him is through you. Of course, if my information is not correct.
Correct. Sure. Sure, it's correct. It's just that I never thought of Mr. Emmerich in connection with this kind of a deal. Excuse me a minute. I'll be right back.
Cobby runs off into the next room and shuts the door. Doc stands, stuffs his gloves in his pocket, and moves to a wall calendar. He puts on a pair of glasses.
Hello.
Doc flips through the pages of Pin-Up Girls. Behind him, the hallway door opens. A tall man in a suit and fedora enters and stuffs his hands in his pocket. Doc faces him. It's Dix. Doc removes his glasses. Cobby returns.
Hello, Dix. What do you want?
I want to make a bet.
Well?
Your man says you got to okay it.
What are you in for?
2,300 and some.
Okay, your tab's good for 2,500. But that's the limit. Either pick a winner or pay me when you get that far.
Don't bone me.
Cobby spins to face him. Dix moves toward the bookie.
Now, look, I'm not boning.
Did I ever welch?
Nobody said you did.
You just boned me.
Look, Dix,
I'm not asking you any favors. I'll go get you your 2,300. Right now.
Dix heads out. Cobby chases after him.
Now, Dix, listen. Will you have a drink? Come on. Dix, come on. Come back here. Have a drink, will you? Can you beat that?
Cobby returns.
Where does he come off blowing a fuse?
Who is he?
A small-time hooligan who's crazy for horses. My book beats him and beats him. He keeps coming back for more. Say, Doc.
Cobby slaps his forehead.
I forgot on account of that big tramp. I spoke to Mr. Emmerich on the phone. He's going to meet us later on tonight. He's giving a dinner party at his house in town for a bunch of swells. But he'll be at another address later on. A man like Emmerich has got more than one place to hang his hat.
Now, at Gus's cafe, Dix takes a seat at the counter where a kitten eats from a bowl. Another customer reads a magazine.
Smart cat. Never does a lick of work, stays out all night, sleeps all day.
What's a big dirty cat doing at an eating joint? I run over one every time I get a chance. People feeding cats and some kids haven't got enough to eat.
You gonna buy that magazine?
Why should I? I've seen all the dames in it already. Want to make something of it?
You're a little off your beat, ain't you, Buster?
How do you mean, Humpty Dumpty?
I mean, you don't belong around here. You're just passing through.
Gus grabs him.
Not fast enough.
He throws him outside.
If I ever see you running over a cat, I'll kick your teeth out.
I'd take you apart if you were about a foot taller and straightened up a little.
Gus takes a step toward him. The man quickly climbs into his truck and drives off. Gus turns to Dix and smiles.
Suppose you want your heater back. You ain't gonna get it. What do you think of that?
Quit kidding, Gus.
I'm in. Go on, get sore. Smack me down.
You know I wouldn't do that.
Look, Dix. Take my advice and knock off for a while. The happiness boys are on a rampage. Headquarters has given them the push.
I can't afford to knock off.
Oh, stop worrying. I'll stake you.
Yeah, I need 2,300.
What?
Something I just gotta take care of.
Cobby, maybe?
Dix nods.
Yeah, let him sweat. It'll do him good. Cobby can spare a few pounds.
You can't owe money to a guy like him, a little loudmouth who bones you when he isn't even trying to.
I don't get you, Dix.
I just can't be in Cobby's debt and keep myself respect.
Oh. All right. I got a grand put away. You can have that. Maybe I can dig up 1,300 more. I guess it's all right to owe me, huh?
I guess.
It's just my luck.
Gus rubs his hands together.
Well, I'll get it tomorrow or bust a gut. In the meantime, stay away from the boulevard, especially at night.
By the way, they knocked over that clip joint, the Club Regal. Wasn't that where Dowell worked?
Yeah. It's coming in bunches, it looks like.
Go home, Dix. Stay home.
Dix turns around on his stool and gets up.
Don't get your flag at half-mast. Remember, you still got old Gus.
Dix strolls out, holding his hands in his pockets. Gus heads across the cafe to a wall-mounted payphone. He drops a coin in the slot and dials. The kitten watches him from the counter. On the other end is a man in pajamas.
$1,300, you must be crazy. But Dix, what do I care for that hooligan? I'd like to help you out, Gus, but I got mouths to feed and rent to pay and all that stuff. You're a low-down scum, that's what you are. Low-down, dirty scum to talk to me like that.
He hangs up, then heads into an adjacent bedroom. Moonlight shines on his face through the window as he stares at his wife in bed. On his right cheek is a dark mole. His wife holds her eyes closed as she rocks a baby carriage beside her. The dark-haired man heads back into the hallway, shutting the door behind him. He picks up the phone and dials.
Look, Gus, I guess I can make it all right.
Now, in another apartment, Dix reads the paper. He presses an intercom button.
Yeah?
It's me, Dahl.
Dahl.
He presses a smaller button on the intercom panel, then opens the door and heads out into the hallway. A brunette fixes her hair as she jogs up a flight of stairs holding a suitcase. Dix eyes her stoically.
Hi, honey.
Come on in.
He heads back into his apartment. Dahl follows him, beaming. Dix pulls a cigarette from his shirt pocket.
Close the door.
For sure, Dick, sure.
She does as he asks, still smiling widely.
I'm awful sorry to bother you, honey, but...
Dix pours some liquor into a shot glass, then faces her. She smiles sheepishly. Dix removes the cigarette from his mouth and downs his drink. Dahl's smile fades. She reaches into her purse, pulls out her own cigarette, and places it into her mouth. Her hand rummages through the purse.
Dahl, if you're gonna smoke, you gotta learn to carry matches.
He lights a match in his hand and holds it out. Dahl sinks into a nearby chair.
Dahl, what are you crying about?
He sits across from her.
No, Dix, no. I'm sorry.
Tears streak her mascara.
Sorry, Dix. I don't know what I was thinking about bothering you at this time of the night. I'll just run along.
Gus told me the Club Regal got knocked over.
Yeah, can you imagine raiding the Regal? The cops must have all gone crazy. So it's a clip joint. So what? And it would have to happen on pay night.
How about a drink?
I don't care if I do. One of my eyelashes is coming off.
She removes a fake eyelash.
Were you locked out of your room?
How'd you guess? Is how.
She throws back her drink.
Dix, if it wouldn't be too much trouble, could I stay here a couple of days?
Dix opens his mouth and glances down. Dahl raises her eyebrows timidly.
Just a day or two.
She avoids his gaze.
All right, stay if you want to, but don't you go getting any ideas, Dahl.
Smiling, she shakes her head, then removes her other eyelash. Now in a study, a tuxedoed man sits in an armchair.
Everything is here, from the observed routine of the personnel to the alarm system. The type of locks on the doors, the age and condition of the main safe, and so forth and so forth. Take my word for it, Mr. Emmerich. This is a ripe plum ready to fall.
My friend, according to the boys, all takes are easy. But as a lawyer, I've made a lot of money getting them out of jail.
Please, Mr. Emmerich, perhaps you know my reputation. I've engineered some very big things.
That's a fact, Mr. Emmerich. Doc here stops.
Am I to understand that you gathered all this information before doing your last stretch?
That is correct. I was ready to begin operations when the coppers grabbed me for an old caper I'd almost forgotten about.
The Adelphia Finance caper. You took them for $160,000, didn't you, Doc?
$158,000.
Cobby shrugs.
And you really believe there's a million in this thing?
Maybe even more.
You mean by that the take will be worth $500,000 to us in actual cash?
Because you know as well as I do that in no case will a fence give you more than 50%.
That's right, sir.
Well, what are your main problems?
There are three. Money to operate, personnel, and finally, the disposing of the take.
No trouble about the first, eh, Mr. Emmerich?
No, wait a minute, Cobby. This remains to be seen.
The helpers will be paid off like house painters. They'll be told nothing about the size of the take. Sometimes men get greedy.
Well, how many helpers do you need?
Only three. A boxman. Him we pay most. Maybe $25,000.
I got a guy for you. Louis Chiavelli. Best boxman west of Chicago. Expert mechanic. Been in some very big capers. What I hear, he can open a safe like the back of a watch. Only he costs.
Then we need a top-notch driver in case of a rumble. He should get 10,000. Mm-hmm. And finally, sad to say, we need a hooligan. Most of these fellas are drug addicts. They're no good lot or they wouldn't be hooligans. Violence is all they know. But they are, unfortunately, necessary. For a more or less reliable man, I'd say 15,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's 50,000 in all.
Emmerich scratches his nose.
How's this take to be handled?
We'll get in touch with the best fencers in the Midwest and deal with whoever makes the highest offer. Maybe no one fence can handle the whole thing. In that case, we deal with two or three.
Half a million, eh?
Emmerich stares off pensively. He gets up and paces.
I'm just thinking.
He holds his hand over his eyes.
If I decide to go into this thing, I might handle it.
You a fence, Mr. Emmerich?
No, Cobby, not exactly. But your proposition looks pretty good. I'd like to see the most made of it. Oh, I suppose a fellow should stick to his own trade, but I know some pretty big men around here that might not be averse to a deal like this if they're properly approached. Highly respectable men, I might add. So why don't you let me see what I can do before you look for a fence?
Cobby and Doc nod.
A few days more or less wouldn't make much difference to you, I don't suppose. Might mean a lot more money for all of us.
Good. There's just one thing. I dislike to mention it, but I've just come from prison and...
Oh, well, of course, Cobby here will be glad to advance you anything you need. See that you have a place to stay. Hey, Cobby?
Yeah, you bet your life. And I got some fancy phone numbers for you too, Doc.
Emmerich helps Doc into his coat.
What's it like, a man of your taste, 7 years behind the walls?
Not too bad. It's a matter of temperament. I cause no trouble. The prison authorities appreciate that. They made me assistant librarian.
I'm afraid I wouldn't make a model prisoner.
After this job, it's Mexico for me. Yes. I live like a king. Mexican girls are very pretty. I'll have nothing to do all day long but chase them in the sunshine. Very kind, sir.
Good night. Good
night.
Emmerich?
Cobby. Doc and Cobby leave. Emmerich shuts the front door behind them, then heads over to a den. He stops at the entrance to the room and cocks his head, grinning. The tuxedo-clad attorney moves to the back of a sofa where a woman with platinum blonde hair lies sleeping. Emmerich's eyebrows twitch as he watches her. The woman groggily opens her eyes and sees him standing over her. She smiles. Emmerich cocks an eyebrow.
What's the big idea standing there staring at me, Uncle Lon?
Don't call me Uncle Lon.
I thought you liked it.
Maybe I did. I don't anymore.
Her eyes follow him as he moves to an armchair. The blonde sits up on the sofa and smiles.
I had the market send over some salt mackerel for you. I know how you love it for breakfast.
Some sweet kid.
She stretches and yawns.
It's late. Why don't you go to bed?
The blonde saunters over to him in her striped pantsuit and leans in for a kiss. As their lips lock, Emmerich sweeps an arm around her shoulders and dips her onto her back. The blonde pushes him away, then flashes a courteous smile. She gets up, taps his hand affectionately, and walks off. Emmerich shakes his head as he watches her go.
Some sweet kid.
The blonde crosses the hall to a bedroom. Keeping her gaze on Emmerich, she slowly swings the door shut. The mustached attorney leans forward and picks up a high-heeled shoe. As he turns it in his hand, his eyes shift thoughtfully. He sets the shoe down and reaches for a phone on a side table. Holding the receiver to his ear, he dials.
Bob Branham? This is Emmerich. No, no, I didn't call you to get the right time. Listen, I've got a job for you. No, no, nothing like that. I've got over $100,000 standing out on my books. Come to my office tomorrow morning. I'll give you a list of the people that owe me. No, no, no. No, use the method called for in each particular case. And don't tell me anything about it. All I want is results.
Daytime at Dix's apartment.
So, boy.
Easy, boy. Easy.
As Dix talks in his sleep, Dahl answers the phone.
Hello? Who? Oh, sure, Gus. He's still asleep. What?
Dix's eyes blink open.
Yeah, I'll tell.
Dahl hangs up and sets the phone down on a table. Dix sits up on the couch.
Honey, that was Gus. He says you can come over anytime. He's got something for you.
Okay.
Coffee, honey, I made fresh.
Yeah.
Hey, you sure were dreaming.
How do you know?
Hey, you were talking in your sleep.
What was I saying?
It was all jumbled up, but I heard one word real plain. You called it out several times. Corn cracker. What's that mean?
Corn cracker. Corn cracker was a colt.
Yeah, it would be.
Dahl sits across from him.
Yeah, he was a tall, black colt. Yeah, I remember I was dreaming. I was up on that colt's back, and my father and my grandfather were there watching the fun. That colt was buck jumping and pitching, and once he tried to scrape me off against the fence, but I stayed with him, you bet. Then I heard my granddaddy say, "He's a real Handley, that boy, a real Handley," and I felt proud as you please.
Did that really happen, Dix? Well, when you were a kid?
Not exactly. The black colt pitched me into a fence on the first buck, and my old man come over and prodded me with his boot and said, "Maybe that'll teach you not to brag about how good you are on a horse."
It's nice to hear you laugh.
You know something? One of my ancestors imported the first Irish thoroughbred into our county.
Is that a fact?
Sure. Well, our farm was in the family for generations. 160 acres. 30 in bluegrass and the rest in crops. Fine barn and 7 brood mares.
Sounds wonderful, Dick.
It was. And then everything happened at once. My old man died and we lost our corn crop. That black colt I was telling you about, he broke his leg and had to be shot. That was a rotten year.
His eyelids twitch with rage.
I'll never forget the day we left. Me and my brother swore we'd buy Hickory Wood Farm back someday.
Growing up in a place and then having to leave must be awful. I never had a proper home.
$12,000 would have swung it. I almost made it once. I had more than $5,000 in my pocket. And Pampoon was running in a Suburban. I figured he couldn't lose. I put it all on his nose. He lost by a nose.
Drink your coffee, honey, before it gets cold.
The way I figure, my luck's just got a turn. One of these days, I'll make a real killing, and then I'm going to hit for home. First thing I do when I get there, I take a bath in the creek and get the city dirt off me.
Dahl raises a coffee cup toward her lips, then puts it down on a saucer and pushes it away.
What's the matter?
Nothing, Dix, nothing.
I say something wrong?
No.
She looks around the room.
But gee, this place is a mess. It needs a good clean.
She straightens up the table.
How can you stand to live like this?
Dahl empties ashtrays onto some newspaper and carries it out. Now in Copy's bedding room, a roll of bills falls off a table onto the floor.
Count it.
Copy moves around his desk and picks it up.
Count it.
Look, Dix, you don't have to pay the whole tab at once.
Go ahead and count it.
Why get sore? There's no reason to get sore.
You boned me in front of a stranger, trying to make me look small.
I tell you, I didn't mean it. I shoot my mouth off. Maybe I have a slight load on. You know how it is, huh?
No, I don't know how it is.
Look, Dix, I made a mistake. Don't you ever make a mistake. Sure. Here, have a drink. Yeah?
He pours Dix a drink.
There you are, Dix. You know, Dix, you got to play the horses the smart way. Save your money. The next time there's a fix going, I'll let you know. It'll be money from home. Money from home.
Cobby glances toward the door.
Excuse me.
He walks off. Dix watches him.
Oh, it's the doc. Come on in, Doc. I want you to meet a friend of mine, Dix Handley. This is Doc Riedenschneider. You heard of him, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Well, how do you like the whiskey? Made in your home state? Oh, there's that, sir.
Kentucky. Boone County, Kentucky.
Best water in the USA.
Is that so?
That's the water makes the whiskey fit to drink. Well?
He downs the rest of the whiskey.
I gotta be going now. See you around sometime, maybe.
So long, Dex.
Cobby smiles as he leaves.
Big hick.
The color of his money's all right, but I wish he wasn't so touchy.
Maybe it's a point of honor with him, a gambling debt.
Him, that hooligan, honor? Don't make me laugh.
He's a hooligan, you say?
Yeah, but a small time, a little stick-up cigar stores, gas stations. And every cent goes to the ponies.
One day or another, I'll be all by club ice.
Cobby flashes a crooked grin.
Let me say that. How was your date last night?
The young lady drank too much to be good company. But the evening wasn't a complete loss. She talked more than if she'd been sober.
Yeah? What about?
Your friend, Mr. Emmerich.
Emmerich? Now, look here, Doc.
There's half a million at stake. I've got to know where I stand. Emmerich must put up before I can hire a coup.
For him, there's nothing. A dead cinch.
The information she gave me is that he's broke.
Are you crazy? I've seen Mr. Emmerich operate for 20 years. He handles only the biggest cases. He's got two houses, four cars, a half a dozen servants.
And one blonde.
Doc, whose word you gonna take, mine or some dim-witted dame?
Yours, naturally.
If he's broke, I would be broke the same way.
Lieutenant Dietrich enters. Doc sees him and quickly faces away. Dietrich turns and heads back to the entrance. Cobby follows.
Lieutenant! Lieutenant!
Dietrich stops at the door.
That guy you saw in my office, he's just passing through.
Shut up. I didn't see anybody. How could I? I wasn't here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Look,
Yeah?
I just came to tell you that you'll have to stand still for a raid.
You mean to have the homie downtown and book me?
It's a short ride.
Look, I thought you were a friend of mine.
Right now, I've got one friend, Dietrich. And Dietrich's going to be out in his ear if you don't make a showing.
All right, but why me? Why pick on me?
Because it's logic. You're the biggest parlor in my precinct. The citizens know it, the newspapers know it, and even I know it. And that Mr. Commissioner knows I know it.
Oh, I just hate to have it happen. I just hate it, that's all.
I'm as sorry as you are.
Look, Lieutenant, I've always given you plenty of cooperation. But you're hitting me at just the wrong time.
He stuffs money into Dietrich's coat.
All right. Close up. Tight. Keep the place dark. Don't answer any phones.
Thanks, Lieutenant. Thanks.
Dietrich leaves. Cobby shuts the door behind him, then buttons his suit jacket and returns to the betting room. Doc stands.
That copper, he recognized me.
How'd you know he's a copper?
I can smell one a block off.
Oh, don't worry about Dietrich. He's on my payroll. Practically a partner. Me and him, we're like that.
Experience has taught me never to trust a policeman. Just when you think one's all right, he turns legit.
Now at Emmerich's house, a tuxedoed butler enters an office.
Hey, Mr. Brenham is here.
Oh, yes. Show him in.
Pardon me, sir. Mrs. Emmerich is not feeling well.
Yes, well. Send for Dr. Hausman.
I already have, sir.
Good. Tell her, say I'll be up to see you later.
The butler steps out and holds the door open. A dark-haired man in a light-colored suit swaggers in.
Well, what about my debtors? How many of them came through?
Branham pulls up a seat.
Not a one.
What's that?
You want all the excuses? I've got some buttes.
Not as bad as that, eh?
Two or three may come through with a part. They promised.
I don't want promises. I want cash.
Look, my friend. Private detective can't go around threatening people. I'd lose my license. 98% of them you're going to have to sue.
There's no time for that. I got to have money. I've got to have it this minute.
What is it? Girl trouble?
Shut up, Branham. That's not funny.
How's that? Nobody tells me to shut up.
Emmerich looks away from him and rubs his forehead. Branham's brow furrows.
Sorry, Bob.
Emmerich retrieves a cigarette from a box on his desk, then digs into his pocket. He throws the cigarette down and buries his face in his hands.
Bob, I'm broke. That's the plain, simple fact. I'm finished. I'm bankrupt.
How could you let a dame like Angela take you this way?
It's not Angela. It's everything. It's my whole way of life. Every time I turn around, it costs thousands of dollars. 10,000 here, 10,000 there. I got to get out. I got to get out from under.
He faces the private investigator.
And the irony of it is that I've got an opportunity, and I can't take it.
Tough.
Emmerich stands.
Bob.
He buttons his pinstripe jacket.
I'm going to hand you the shock of a lifetime.
He stuffs his hands in his jacket pockets and walks around the desk.
Did you ever hear of Doc Riedenschneider?
Sure. Behind the walls, isn't he?
No, he's out. He got out last week. Cobby brought him to me. He's got a plan. Beautifully worked out. For the biggest caper ever to be pulled in the Middle West. Only he wants $50,000 backing.
Would be taken.
Emmerich widens his eyes.
Bella tears. The rocks alone would be worth, conservatively speaking, $500,000.
How much would you get out of it?
Third of the take.
Brother, you're knocking me out.
What if I were to tell you that I've got a plan worked out to get it all?
Branham's heavy-lidded eyes narrow.
I could tell them that I'd fence the stuff myself, you see. Promise them cash on delivery. Then...
He moves back behind his desk.
When the time comes, I simply wouldn't have the cash, you understand? I'd tell them it'd take a few days more to raise it.
He takes a seat.
I'm certain I could get them to leave the stuff with me while we're waiting.
Go on.
Well, then I'd disappear. I'd take a plane to another country, to another life. The gold and platinum I could melt up and sell as bullion, you see. And the rocks, sell them one at a time. Be no hurry. It'd last a lifetime.
How wrong can a guy be? Here I was worrying about your nerves, and you were dreaming up a double cross like this.
Yes. But I can't do it because I haven't got $50,000.
I can tell you how to raise it.
You? How?
What's in it for me?
50-50.
Okay. But we may get ourselves killed, my friend.
Emmerich looks away from him soberly.
Yes, I know. Well, how do we raise the money?
Simple. Cobby.
Cobby?
Believe me, he can dig it up without half trying.
Yes. Oh, but what do we tell him? Why do I need money?
Leave it to me. Cobby wants to feel big. Here's his chance. Advancing money for the great Alonzo P. Emmerich. He'll do it. He'll sweat, but he'll do it.
Back at Cobby's betting room.
What boxes have you opened?
Cannonball, double door, even a few fire chests. All of them.
Can you open the vault with the time lock and the relocking device?
Sure.
What do you use, lock or seam?
Seam.
Ever taken one?
Remember the Shafter job?
Yes, I heard about it behind the vaults. It was a good score. Who supplies your soup?
I thrash it myself.
How are you as a picklock?
I can open anything in 4 minutes.
He'll do.
You're in.
Not so fast. What's the cut?
No cut. You get a flat guarantee.
I want 30,000.
30,000? Now, Louis.
25 is roughly figured.
All right, 15 down.
10 down.
15 is satisfactory, I think. There's your paymaster.
Doc points at Cobby with the wet end of his cigar. The bookie sets a tin box on his desk and pulls out a stack of bills. He sits, wiping the sweat from his head, then begins counting. Louis Chiavelli, the man with the mole on his cheek, stands over him, grinning.
What are you sweating for?
Money makes me sweat, that's all. It's the way I am.
Doc methodically lets out a puff of cigar smoke. Louis faces him.
Who are the others in this job, Doc?
Haven't got him yet.
There's only one driver as far as I'm concerned. Gus Manisi. That's Cobby. He knows him.
Gus? 100%.
Get hold of him.
He'll take all the heat and won't flap his lip.
Get hold of him.
Sure, Doc.
Any ideas about a hooligan?
Cobby waves his finger.
I know a very good heavy. I haven't seen him in some time. Red trainer.
He's taking a cure.
Rule him out.
What about Timmons?
Who's that?
My doorman.
That busted down wrestler. Are you kidding? He's got nothing upstairs but solid knuckle.
I'm a stranger and do not know as much as you gentlemen. But what about this southerner, the Sticks? He impressed me as a very determined man and far from stupid.
Louis shrugs.
Frankly, I don't like the guy. But I never saw a hooligan I did like. They're like left-handed pitchers. They all have a screw loose somewhere. I suppose he's as good as anybody, though. Gus thinks he's tops, and Gus is usually right.
I like him. I say we take him.
Suits me. You're the boss. Well, I better be getting home now. Mrs. Chiavelli's worried about the kid.
What's the trouble?
He's got a cold again. She takes him out first thing in the morning. It's cold then. She claims the baby's got to taste fresh air. Like I'm always telling her.
If you want fresh air, don't look for it in this town. Here.
He opens up his wallet, hands it to Doc, and points at a photo.
He's 9 months old there.
I must say I envy you being a family man.
Yeah. Huh? Always problems, huh?
Louis slides his wallet back into his pocket and leaves. Cotty smiles at Doc.
One good thing about Dick's Hanley, you can get him for nickels and dimes.
Tell me something, Cobby. It's your money, isn't it? Not Mr. Amex.
Cobby locks up his money box.
What difference does it make?
None, really.
Cobby leans forward in his seat.
It's this way. Mr. Emmerich doesn't want this transaction appearing in his books. I'm not risking anything. He's good for it in case of a runout.
Then you haven't got a boy.
Cobby shakes his head and sits back.
No.
He props his feet up on the table and tilts his chair to the wall. Now, in Dix's apartment, Dahl holds a suitcase.
Where are you going?
Well, I found a place. A girlfriend of mine's leaving town, and she's letting me have her apartment. So the rent's paid up till the first of the month.
When did all this happen?
Well, this morning, before you woke up, I bumped into her on the street. You remember that tall brunette used to do the novelty dances at the bandwagon, Blanche LaRue? It sure was nice of her. I can't go living off you forever, can I?
I was glad to help out.
Well, maybe I can do something for you sometime.
Dick shakes his head.
You don't owe me a thing. Forget it.
Well, goodbye.
How you fixed for dough?
Oh, a couple of bucks, enough.
Here, take this and the...
No, thanks, Dick. I'm all through bothering you.
She sets down her suitcase.
Give us a kiss, huh?
She closes her eyes and puckers. Dick holds her shoulders as he kisses her. Dahl pulls away, her eyes blinking. She picks up her suitcase and heads out the door. Dix watches her descend the stairs.
Dahl!
Yes, Dix?
They meet at the top of the stairs.
Maybe I want to get in touch with you.
Oh. Sure, my new address. I'll be at 42 Merton Street.
42 Merton.
He writes it down. Dahl heads back down the stairs. Dix returns to his apartment. He swings the door shut and approaches a telephone.
Hello.
Oh, Dix?
Yeah.
Dix, this is Cobby.
Oh, how are you, Cobby?
I got your number from Gus.
Yeah.
Now, look, Dix.
Right.
Later.
Everything's here. The soft spot's an old steam tunnel. Manhole's on the corner. You drop into the manhole at 11:45. Dix will cover you. You break through the wall. It'll take about 6 minutes to get into Pelletier's from the furnace room. Watch out for floor wires. Make your way up the back stairs and jump the alarm system. That'll take another 3 minutes. At exactly 11:54, Dix and I will come to the back door. You open it for us.
I'll be waiting for you.
Good. Any questions?
Everything sounds okay.
Same here.
Well, guess I better be getting home.
How's the boy?
Oh, he's okay. Ran a temperature yesterday. Pretty high, too. We called the doctor, but temperatures don't mean so much with kids. He's like the normal today. See you tomorrow night, 11:30.
Good night. Have you got a minute, Dix?
Sure, what's on your mind?
My friend, what do you know about this fellow, Emmerich?
You mean the big fixer? I've heard his name, that's all.
I can talk to you, I think.
Sure.
Mr. Emmerich is taking the jewelry off our hands.
Dix takes a drag on his cigarette.
You sure are surprising me, Doc.
I don't exactly trust Mr. Emmerich. Just a feeling. I may be wrong. But it's up to us to collect, you and me. Everything may go smooth. But if it don't...
If he's got it, we'll collect.
Good. We'll meet Mr. Emmerich after the caper, deliver the jewelry, and get our money. The payment is to be immediate and in cash. After that, we pay off and scatter.
Don't worry, Doc. We'll collect.
He gets up. Now at Emmerich's house, the mustached attorney closes a suitcase in his bedroom. He moves to the dresser and folds a plane ticket and passport into his wallet, then stuffs it into his jacket pocket. He picks up the suitcase from his bed and heads out to the hallway. The next door sits open.
Lon. Is that you?
Emmerich walks away.
Lon!
Yes, May?
He returns and stands in the doorway.
Come in, Lon.
I've got a business appointment.
Sit down a minute.
Emmerich approaches his wife's canopied bed.
It's 11:30. Isn't that rather late for business? Lon.
Yes, May?
I'm not feeling well.
My dear, you haven't been feeling well for a long time.
Tonight I get nervous, and when I get nervous, I hate to stay in this house all by myself.
Oh, now, look here. May, you're not here alone. There are three servants in the house. All you have to...
I know. Press the button.
Well, what do you want me to do?
May nods at a bedside chair.
Sit down, Lon.
He sits.
What? Will I sit here and watch you read a magazine?
Would that be so awful?
Oh, now look, May.
We could play cards. Casino, like we used to.
Some other night.
Please, Lon, just one hand. I couldn't sleep last night. I got to thinking of the old days. How we used to like to stay up and play casino. Just the two of us.
Yes, I wish I could stay, but I can't. My dear, this is business. I tell you what I'll do. I'll look in later, and if you're still awake, we'll have a little game.
May sadly shuffles a deck of cards as her husband heads out to the hallway and retrieves his suitcase. He passes a grandfather clock on his way down a twisting flight of stairs. Nighttime. In an alley, Dix waits against a wall as a car approaches from around the corner. The car stops and Dix climbs in. Later, the car turns past a chain-link fence into a parking lot. Dix tosses a lit cigarette out of the passenger window as an attendant approaches.
Take your keys, please. We're closing up.
Okay.
The attendant hands him a claim ticket as he climbs out. Louis follows him through the passenger side door. Dix helps the safecracker into his overcoat.
All set?
Yeah.
Buttoning up his coat, Louis leads Dix away. Neon storefront lights shine in the distance. Elsewhere, Doc carries a briefcase down a street. Gus pulls a car up alongside him, and the mustached ex-con climbs in. Meanwhile, Dix and Louis walk into a dark alley. Behind them, a street lamp casts an arc of light over a brick wall. Louis glances over his shoulder, then pulls a crowbar out from underneath his overcoat. He latches the hook into a manhole cover, and Dix pries it away. Louis climbs waist-high into the hole. Dix crouches down to him as he removes a vial from his overcoat.
Better be careful how you handle this stuff. They'll pick you up in little pieces.
Dix takes the vial from him and nestles it in the top of his fedora, which sits nearby on the ground. Louis climbs down into a narrow corridor of pipes. Overhead, Dix slides the manhole cover back into place and carefully picks up the vial. He puts on his fedora and strolls off with the vial concealed in his palm. Below, Louis steps over to a thick, upturned pipe and stops. He unravels a blueprint and checks his bearings, then moves forward several paces. Kneeling, he holds a chisel against the brick wall and bangs into it with a sledgehammer. He whacks the crumbling bricks with the sledgehammer. Louis chisels into a higher brick. Outside, Gus pulls his car into the parking lot and stops. Doc turns to him.
What time have you got?
Gus shows him his watch.
Good.
Doc climbs out with his briefcase. Gus looks through the open driver's side window and waves his fingers. Doc heads around the car and meets up with Dix, who leads him into the alley. Gus rubs his hunched shoulder as he watches them go.
Good luck, Doc.
In the alley.
Will he give you the suit?
Dix shows him the vial as they walk. Doc nods. Underground, Louis pushes through a hole in the brick wall. He gets to his feet and heads through a maintenance door to a staircase. Outside, Doc leads Dix around the corner of a brick wall to a recessed entranceway numbered 846. They wait in front of a gated door. Inside, Louis hooks a clamp onto a wire above the door. Outside, Dix watches the street as the door opens behind him. Louis unlocks the retractable gate with a pick and pulls it open. He lets his two cohorts in, then relocks the gate. The three walk through a marble lobby, past display cases of china, silver, and glassware. As they approach a gated vault, Doc stops several feet in front of it and waves his pointed finger in a line from one side to the other.
Here's the electric eye.
Louis gets down on his back and slides past a knee-high box on the wall to the bars of the gate. He gets back to his feet, selects a lockpick from a ring, and unlocks the door. As he slides it open, Doc holds up the briefcase. Louis leans over the invisible alarm beam and takes it from him. He sets it down, then scans the vault as he removes his overcoat. He drops it beside the briefcase and reaches beneath his tie. As he steps back outside the gate, his gloved hands unfurl a tiny string noose.
Soup.
Dix hands over the vial and Louis ties it to his string. As he moves to the vault lock, Dix walks off and Doc takes a seat. Dix heads past a display case to a window. He pulls back the curtain and peers through. Outside, a car passes on the street, and pedestrians mill about on the sidewalk. Dix glances back at his cohorts, then moves to another window. Meanwhile, Louis drills through the vault door. Doc lights up a cigar, then checks his watch. While observing Louis's work, Doc calmly draws in his cigar smoke. Later, Louis sticks putty around the perimeter of the vault door. Doc checks his watch again as Louis climbs onto a chair, balling the putty in his hands. Watching him curiously, Doc rises and steps close to the invisible alarm beam. Louis bites onto the cork of the vial at the end of the string. He twists it open and reaches inside with a dropper.
It's gonna take a lot to blow this baby.
With a gloved hand, he carefully withdraws a dropper full of liquid from the vial and squeezes it out along the door. He then repeats the process, still holding the cork in his teeth. Doc's eyes widen as he watches him. Louis puts away the dropper and reseals the vial with the cork. He steps down from the chair and reaches for the briefcase. Doc's gaze follows his movements as he unravels a pair of wires from the putty and backs out through the gate. Louis gets onto his back and cautiously slides underneath the invisible alarm beam. On the other side, he gets to his feet and feeds the wires to a wall around the corner. Doc stands over him as he licks the exposed end of one wire and sticks it into a socket hole. He then licks the other one and looks up at his smoking accomplice.
Here goes.
He inserts the second wire. In a fiery burst, the vault door swings open. Dix peers out the window. Across the street, pedestrians mill about, their heads turning. Inside the vault, Louis carries his overcoat to a wall safe labeled Belletier's. Doc calmly draws on his cigar as Louis pounds the safe with a mallet. Doc's gaze drifts. Louis looks up from his work.
What's that?
Keep going.
Doc's eyes shift pensively. Back in the lobby, Dix steps away from the window. He enters the vault.
Hey, Doc, alarms are going off all over the block.
The blast must have shook up the whole system.
What do we do?
I would hate to leave now. We're so close.
I'm for finishing what we started.
How about you, Louis?
It's okay with me.
Will Gus hold still?
Don't worry about Gus.
Dix keeps watch at the vault door as Louis returns to his work. His drill wrenches away from the safe.
What's the matter?
Drill broke.
As he replaces the bit, Doc checks his watch.
We should finish before 12:15, before the watchman gets here.
A store cop? Let me worry about him.
Dix's steely eyes shift and he narrows his gaze. Doc turns.
Here, Dad, Dix.
Yeah.
Coming this way?
From the river. Don't sound good.
Dix, take a look. See what's happening.
Louis pounds into the safe lock with his chisel and sledgehammer, then swings open the heavy outer doors. Inside is a second pair of doors. Louis selects a lockpick from his ring and quickly gets them open. He glances at Doc with a smile, then moves out of the way. The older thief crouches down to the safe and picks up the first in a stack of velvet-lined jewel cases. Light reflects off rows of shiny gems. He drops the jewels into the open briefcase, then moves on to the rest of the stack. Standing over him, Louis picks the locks of several smaller compartments in the safe. Meanwhile, in the lobby, Dix peers through the window curtain. Outside, a police car stops at the building across the street. Several officers climb out and race up the building's front steps. Dix moves away from the window. Back in the vault, Doc empties the rest of the safe's contents into his briefcase. He stands.
We're gonna blow a bear.
This is everything of real value.
Doc jostles his briefcase.
Heavy, ain't
you? Plenty.
Louis sets the vial inside the safe.
This is the biggest one yet. Wait till you see it in the papers.
Doc carries the briefcase outside the gate, gets on his back, and slips underneath the invisible alarm beam. Louis slides the gate shut and follows. The three criminals walk casually across the lobby to the front door. Dix opens a window hatch and peeks through. On the wall outside, the shadow of a man in a hat approaches. Dix quickly closes the hatch and faces the others.
Watchman, pull open the door, Louis.
Maybe he'll go away.
Do what makes sense.
Dix stands beside the door as Louis grabs the handle.
No.
Dix socks the watchman, who drops his gun. The gun fires at Louis. As he clutches his abdomen, Dix grabs him. Doc leads them through another door to the basement. Downstairs, he holds open the maintenance door for Dix, who helps Louis through. The wounded safecracker leans weakly against his brawnier accomplice's body as Doc ducks through the hole in the brick wall. Once on the other side, he helps Louis through and pulls him to his feet. Dix joins them. Outside, another police car pulls up. A third police car arrives. Underground, inside the narrow corridor of pipes, Doc walks at a steady pace, his cigar in his mouth. Behind him, Dix helps Louis. Doc stops at the ladder and shoulders his wounded cohort's weight as Dix climbs up. Outside, the manhole cover slides aside and Dix's upper torso emerges. He quickly surveys the area, then climbs the rest of the way out. Louis follows him up, and Dix helps him to his feet. As they move off, Doc emerges with the briefcase. Nearby, police officers and onlookers rush over to a well-lit building. Meanwhile, Dix holds Louis's arm as they lead Doc through the alley into the parking lot. Gus runs over and takes the wounded man's other arm.
Gus, take me home.
What'd it get
you? Cut me in the thigh. I can feel it going up. I think I got the slug in the belly.
I'll take you to a guy I know. He used to be a doctor.
Now, take me home, Gus. Take me home.
Dix drops Louis into the passenger seat of Gus's car as the hunchbacked cook runs around to the driver's side. Dix shuts the door, then gets behind the wheel of the other car, where Doc sits patiently. The car backs up, then drives off past the alley. Now at Emmerich's cottage, the mustached attorney paces the living room, smoking a cigarette. Branham sits on the couch.
It's after one, they should be here in a minute.
Branham stares at his drink.
Unless there's been trouble.
Where's Angela tonight?
No, she's at the sister's.
Says.
I'd go easy on that liquor if I were you.
Half drunk, I got better wits than most people.
He pats a holster beneath his jacket.
And more nerve.
He reclines.
You look worried, my friend. Something bothering you?
Emmerich turns away from him.
Live and learn. All these years I've been suffering from an inferiority complex. I should have been in the money years ago. You big boys. What have you got? Front. Nothing but front. And when that slips, I do believe our guests are arriving.
As he opens the door, a cigarette dangles from Emmerich's mouth. Doc and Dix enter with the briefcase.
Well, everything go all right?
Doc gives the briefcase a shake. Branham wanders over.
Well, this is a friend of mine, Mr. Branham. He's been a great help to me on this deal. Follow me. Follow me, gentlemen. It's much more comfortable in here.
Doc follows him into the study, giving Branham an uncertain look as he passes. Dix stares at the private detective until he turns away after the others. Emmerich smiles at Doc.
Say, I'll bet that thing is full of Kohinoors and Grand Moguls, eh?
Could be.
Sit down, gentlemen, sit down. Let me get you a drink.
No, thanks.
Do you mind if we have a look?
You're entitled to a look, naturally.
Doc opens the briefcase. Branham and Emmerich gape as he puts a handful of jewels on the table, then reaches in with two hands and lets a pile of loose gems stream back into the case through his fingers. Emmerich holds up a clear stone and shows Branham as Doc sweeps the strewn pieces back into the case. Dix eyes them warily, and Emmerich hands the gem back to Doc.
Convinced?
Why, of course, of course. There never was any doubt in my mind. You know, I know this fellow's reputation. Just a matter of curiosity, that's all. I'll bet the appraisal is going to exceed even your estimate.
Good, good. In that case, I'd just like to see the color of your money.
Emmerich smiles.
Gentlemen, I must admit at this moment I'm embarrassed.
You mean you haven't got the money, Mr. Emmerich?
Oh, I have it. That is, I have the assurance of it.
You haven't got it?
No, I haven't got the currency right here in my hands. But it's promised by an unimpeachable source. Gentlemen, I'm afraid we were a little hasty. We moved too fast.
We moved on your word.
Well, now, wait a minute. That's a large sum of money, you know, considering present-day conditions, and considering the fact that we had to have it in cash. So I'm afraid a few days more are needed to raise it.
A few days more may not seem like a very long time to you, Mr. Emmerich, but to me, carrying this around, it would seem like years.
I understand. I've got a solution for that, too. That is, if you boys trust me. And if you don't, well, there's nothing I can say except that I'm sorry.
Mr. Emmerich, what are you trying to tell us?
About the jewels. Wouldn't be safe for you to carry that stuff around. You said so yourself.
You mean we leave them with you?
Well, now, look here. When the police start looking for that stuff tomorrow morning, they're not likely to call me up. They're not likely to send detectives out to search my house, you know. You, on the other hand, Doc, you're just out of prison. They're certainly going to be looking for the big-timers, like yourself.
Doc's eyes narrow.
Some smart cop might even connect this burglary with your release.
Emmerich looks to the stern-faced hooligan as Branham watches, his face half-shadowed. Smoke drifts past Emmerich's nervous face.
Well, there you are. Of course, as I said, it's up to you. You can keep in touch with me through Cobby.
You did a great job, Emmerich, but it's not working.
Bob!
Back away and keep out of this, Emmerich.
Branham grins, pointing his
gun.
Now
you, Farmer, get your hands up.
Dix raises his arms.
And you, Fritz. Further back on the floor. Over here by my feet. Be careful how you throw it. I got a pistol expert medal.
What do you say, Dix?
He's got no say. He makes a crooked move, he'll never pitch another forkful of manure.
Dix sighs, staring coldly.
He's got us, Doc. Toss him the bag.
You're not as dumb as you look.
Dix draws as the briefcase is in the air. Both men fire and Branham slumps into his chair. As Doc leans over and checks Branham's eyes, Emmerich sobs into his hands. Dix checks a bullet wound in his side.
Are you a man or what? Trying to chip and double-cross with no guts for it.
Dix towers over Emmerich.
What's inside of you? What's keeping you alive?
Emmerich slowly looks up and sees Dix pointing his pistol at him. He stands and stares blankly at Dix.
Why don't you kill me? What's stopping you? Okay, Mr.
Dix, listen to me. Don't kill him. It's too easy and out for him. Sit down, sir.
Dix holds his wound as the two older men sit.
Whatever possessed you to pull such a stunt?
I was broke, facing bankruptcy.
Doc, he's a witness. He saw me knock off that guy there. You think he wouldn't holler if they turned the heat on him?
He's in no position to talk. What did you and your man there on the floor intend to do with the jewels?
Leave town? Sell them off a little at a time?
No good. The police would have been on you after the first sale. You can't go peddling stuff like this around when the heat's on.
Let's blow, Doc. Let's not fool around here any longer.
Be patient, Dix. Mr. Emmerich got us into this hole, and he's going to get us out. I didn't save your life because I'm a lover of humanity. We're in trouble with this satchel full of jewels. As things stand, it's just so much junk.
There's nothing I can do.
Yes, there is, Mr. Emmerich. You can go to the insurance company.
Insurance company?
Now, listen to reason. This is a very bad jolt for them. And it's possible they'll be willing to buy the jewels back, no questions asked, for as high as 25% of what they're worth.
Doc, let's blow.
I'll start on it tomorrow.
Get busy, Emmerich. And remember, you might have been lying here dead with your friend.
Doc heads out.
Shall I get in touch with you through Cobby?
No, I'll get in touch with you. Come on, Dix. I advise you to clean up after your friend.
Now, in Louis' apartment, his wife walks from their bedside to the cupboard. Gus watches her.
Don't give him any water.
Yes, Louis.
As she fills a glass, Gus grabs her.
I said don't give him any water.
Let go.
What do you want to kill him? Maybe he's hurt in the stomach.
Where is the doctor? Why doesn't he come? You said 10 minutes is half an hour. Louis will die. Why can't I take my Louis to the hospital?
You take him to a hospital, they wheel him into an operating room, you'll never see him again.
She weeps, holding her face.
Take it easy, Maria. Louis's gonna be all right. Doctor will be here in a minute, fix him up good as new. You and Louis are gonna have 6 more kids. All as fat as pigs, big black eyes, lots of hair. Just like Louis, eh, Maria?
Stay away from the baby!
Gus turns from tickling the baby and scowls at her. He walks from the crib and returns to his seat at the kitchen table. Maria faces him.
Tell me the truth, Gus. How did it happen?
I told you, fight.
Louis, don't fight. You know that.
All right.
Gus keeps his gaze on the floor.
Why is it always you? Whenever Louis gets into trouble, you're around. You dirty cripple, you crooked back. You have the evil eye.
Shut your mouth, Maria. I don't let anybody say that to me.
She turns from Gus's wild eyes. Gus gets to his feet and walks to an open window. As he stares out, Maria looks back to him with dark, mournful eyes.
I'm sorry, Gus. I got to blame somebody.
What I carry on my back, I was born with it. I didn't grow it myself.
Please forgive me, Gus. I didn't mean it.
As Gus stares out at the city, Maria suddenly looks up. She stands, and the soft light reflects off her satiny robe.
Listen to that.
Yeah. It must be a fire. It's not in this neighborhood, though. Someplace else.
Well, Gus, I pray to God that doctor get here quick.
Be here any minute, Maria.
They stare out the window.
Sounds like a soul in hell.
A gentle breeze rustles the window's curtains. Now, on a deserted bridge, Emmerich gets out of his car in a dark coat and hat. He reaches into the back seat and drags out Branham's lifeless body. Emmerich inches his way to the edge of the bridge and looks over. Moonlight reflects off the dark water far below. Emmerich heaves Branham onto the railing and dumps the body over the side. The limp corpse plummets into the water. Emmerich soberly watches it sink. Now Doc puffs a cigar in Cobby's bedding room as Dix pats his bloody side with a cloth. Cobby paces the room, rubbing his forehead.
Dix, why don't you get in touch with Gus and let him take you to that doctor? Don't be foolish.
I don't like doctors. I'm getting along all right. That bullet just ripped through my side and went on about its business. Good thing I jumped.
How can things go so wrong? How's it possible? One man killed, two others plugged. I'm out 30 grand. We got a load of rocks. We can't even pet them.
Why don't you quit crying and give me some bourbon?
Cobby pours Dix a drink and shakes his head.
Oh, I must be awful stupid. Here I am with a good business.
Dix downs the shot.
Money rolling in. I gotta get mixed up in a thing like this. I ought to have my head examined.
Cobby strides to the phone.
Yeah, hello, hello. Yeah, this is Cobby. What?
It's Gus Stragnitz out in the combing the district.
He wants to talk to you. You, Dix.
Cobby passes Dix the receiver.
Gus, Dix.
Yeah, now listen careful, pal. The cops are knocking over all the joints along the boulevard. There's mobs up, meat wagons and all. Now look, I already called the guy, Eddie Donato. Donato's got a grocery down by the river, 116 Front Street. You got that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you,
Louis's not so good. He got a slug in his belly, all right. Doc's doing all he can. Here they are now, the happiness boys.
A policeman raps on the window.
Oh, how are you? Yeah, looks like a minute of working over. Look, go down to Eddie's by way of the old car barn. Yeah, it's deserted at night. Once you get beyond that, you're okay. The cops never bother in this neighborhood. So long, Dix. Blow now, huh? All right, all right, all right.
Now a sign on a 3-story building reads, Donato's Groceries. Inside, Doc and Dix wait in an upstairs loft.
What? Please, talk a little louder. This is Eddie Donato. Oh, sure, sure. I'll get it down for you. Hey, dottore, I got your men.
Doc hurries downstairs and takes the phone from a man wearing an apron.
Hello?
Donato walks off, and Dix looks down the stairwell.
Fine, fine. Good. That'll be satisfactory.
Doc hangs up. He climbs back up to the brick loft, smiling at Dix. They sit at a small table with two plates of spaghetti.
Cobby?
Yes. Emily came through. The insurance people say okay. Of course, we'll have to wait till the banks open Monday morning. But it's $250,000, which is not bad.
Now Emmerich plays cards on his wife's bed.
As a lawyer, you may be very brilliant, Lon. But as a casino player, you have a lot to learn.
You don't mind if I smoke?
Of course not, Lon.
He plays another card.
Lon, how could you make a play like that? You won't make a single point this hand.
Come in.
Two gentlemen to see you, sir. They are from the police department.
What on earth could they want, Lon?
Oh, something to do with the case, I suppose. Excuse me?
Father, we were having so much fun. Hurry back.
Sure.
Patting his wife's hand, he walks out past the butler. Now, from the balcony, Emmerich looks down at two men in pale trench coats standing beneath a crystal chandelier. Emmerich calmly walks down the curving staircase to a dark-haired detective.
Yes?
Sorry to disturb you, Mr. Emmerich. I'm Andrews. This is Officer Janicek.
How do you do?
How are you?
Well, what can I do for you?
Do you know a man named Robert Branham?
Branham, yes, of course. Well, what is it? Something the matter?
There sure is, Mr. Emmerich. His body was pulled out of the river this morning.
Great heavens.
But it was no drowning. He had a hole through his pump. He'd been shot.
Emmerich glances upstairs.
Will you step in here for a minute?
The detectives enter a study, and Emmerich closes the double doors behind them.
Well, I must say, this is it's quite a shock. Bob Branham, eh? Murdered, you say? Great heavens.
We found a list of names in his pocket written on your business stationery. Who are these people, you know?
Oh, that's a list of my debtors. Branham was working for me. He was trying to collect some old debts. Without much success, I must say.
Was he giving the treatment to anybody on this list?
Giving the treatment? Certainly not.
Then you don't think there's any connection between this work you say he was doing for you and his death?
None whatever.
When did you see him last?
Well, now, last Wednesday evening in this room. Yes, we went over that list together.
Mm-hmm. The coroner says he was plugged about 1 or 2 o'clock this morning. Not much after the Pelletier job was pulled. We figure there might be a connection. One of the heist guys was shot. We know that. There was blood on the floor. Maybe it was Branham's. He could have died in a getaway car and the others dropped him in the river.
Oh, no, no, no. Bob Branham's a good deal of a roughneck, but he's no criminal. And if I'm any judge, Pelletier's was the work of big-time professionals. Oh, no, no, gentlemen. Bob Branham mixed up in any burglary, why... That's inconceivable.
I see. Oh, one more thing, Mr. Emmerich. Just for the records, of course. Could you give us an account of your whereabouts last night?
Yes, I could.
He puffs his cigarette.
Why, is it necessary?
I'm afraid so, Mr. Emmerich.
Well, boys, a man of my years hates to make an admission like this, but a Miss Finley is living in my cottage on the river. And last night I went to visit her at about... 11:30, I think it was. Stayed rather late. Well, she'll verify this, of course. Oh, but boys, use a little discretion, eh? Unless, of course, it serves some useful purpose.
I understand, Mr. Emmerich, and thank you very much for your help.
Not at all, thank you. And say, if I can be any further help, you just call on me, okay? Eh?
Emmerich gives a friendly salute, and the detectives exit the study. As they meet the butler outside, Emmerich closes the door and hastily strides past an elaborate bookcase to the phone. With a furrowed brow, he picks up the polished black receiver and dials.
Hello, Angela?
Yes.
This is Lon.
Oh, Lon, why haven't you called?
Listen, baby, you may have a visit from the police.
Is it your wife?
No, it's nothing like that. They'll probably ask you some questions about last night. Now, listen, baby. I want you to tell them that I was there with you from 11:30 until 3 in the morning.
Most of the night.
Most of the night, that's right. Now, is that clear?
Sure, it's clear, but you wouldn't...
Yes. No. Just politics, baby. Good old dirty politics.
All right, will you call me right away?
Yes. Yes, I'll call you later.
Don't forget.
Yes.
Back in the bedroom, May brushes her short gray streaked hair. Noticing the outer door opening, she brushes faster, then tucks the matching silver hand mirror and brush under the blankets. She smiles brightly as her husband enters.
Can we go on playing?
Certainly. Why not?
Well, Lon, you're as pale as a ghost. What's the matter?
Turning away, he slides his hand into his pocket.
Well, I just had some bad news. A man who works for me got killed.
Oh, Lon, how awful. Was it an accident?
No. No, it was,
He returns to his seat at her bedside.
An intentional killing.
Do they know who did it?
No.
Oh, Lon, when I think of all those awful people you come in contact with, downright criminals, I get scared.
He stares ahead.
Oh, nothing so different about them. After all, crime is only a left-handed form of human endeavor.
Back at Donato's, Dix plays solitaire on a cot. Doc puffs on a cigar, staring off dreamily.
Ever been in Mexico City, Dix?
Nope.
It's 8,000 feet up. The air is very pure. Many first-class clubs and restaurants, a horse track, and girls. Beautiful young girls. How would you like to go there, all expenses paid?
Sorry, Doc, not interested. I'm heading home.
Listen, Dix, you can always go home. And when you do, it's nothing. Believe me, I've done it. Nothing.
My mind's made up.
Dix opens the door and Donato holds out a newspaper.
Look, my friends.
Doc's mugshots are on the front page.
My friends, I am a respectable man. For gosh, I do a favor, all right. With this speech in the paper.
You mean you want us to blow, is that right, Eddie? Okay. The sooner we get out of here, the better. Our friend Eddie's getting to the place where he'd talk with a little encouragement.
Oh, no. I don't talk. Gus cut my belly open. I'm sorry, my friends, to bring you this bad news. I go now, please.
Sit down, Donato. You're not going anyplace, well, I say so.
Donato grabs for the door. Dick slams it and pushes him down on the cot.
Stay put, Eddie. Nobody's going to hurt you so long as you sit still and keep your mouth shut.
They grab their hat and coats.
The way I figure, the insurance guys must have sicked the cops on that big phony and he spilled.
Donato cowers.
You never should have stopped me, Doc, when I was going to blast him.
No, Dix. He hasn't spilled. Or they wouldn't be looking for just me.
Then how come?
Because there's only three or four men who can manage a job like this. Somebody in the department with a few brains has decided I'm the guy. I've been half expecting it. It doesn't worry me much. We'll get our money tomorrow, you bet.
I hope so.
Where are we going, Dix?
I know a place. Eddie, if you're a smart boy, you'll forget you've ever seen us.
Now in a police station, several men stand around waiting. A taxi driver enters and approaches the officer at the desk.
I want to see the commissioner.
State your business.
Look, I'm a citizen. I can see the commissioner if I want to, can I?
Is it about Riedenschneider?
Could be.
He sure gets around, that guy. About 5,000 people have seen him in the last 24 hours.
If you just get on that line over there and wait your turn,
you can tell me a story.
I won't tell anybody but the commissioner.
Okay, okay. Sit down and wait, buddy. But it may be some time.
Okay. I'd like to see the commissioner.
Nighttime. Doc and Dick stride through an abandoned train yard. As they step onto a platform, an older police officer steps out and they stop. The officer shines a large flashlight at them.
Where do you guys think you're going?
On our way home.
Yeah? Where do you live?
South on Camden.
You guys got no business in here. This is city property. There's signs all over the place.
Everybody uses it.
You're telling me even a bunch of hoodlums have been bringing young girls in here.
Is that a fact?
Yeah. It's already cost one of our boys his job on account of the peace. If I were you guys, I'd stay out of here. You understand?
Okay, officer.
Doc nods and walks past the officer.
Hey, wait a minute. You with the bag. Come here.
Dick steps in front of the flashlight's beam. As the officer reaches for his gun, he punches Dix. Doc rushes the officer and gets hit over the head with the flashlight. As Doc goes down, Dix beats the officer to the ground. Dix helps his friend to his feet. Doc's forehead shines with dark blood. Doc picks up the briefcase and takes a few wobbly steps. Dix leads him away, placing Doc's hat back on his head. They stagger off. Now in a dark apartment, Dahl sits up in bed and switches on a small lamp. She bobs her head groggily, then stands, grabbing a robe. She wearily stumbles over to the door, opens a peephole, and looks out.
Who
Dick?
She opens the door for the criminals.
Oh, Dick's, honey.
Doc nods, his face streaked with blood.
You'll have to excuse me. I took a couple of sleeping pills, and I guess I'm still kind of groggy. I haven't been able to sleep much lately, Dick's worrying about you and everything. I was up at your place, and they told me the cops were after you.
Give me some cold water and some towels and stop yapping.
Sure, Dick, sure.
Get a move on.
Well, you bet.
Put in hours and hours of planning. Figure everything down to the last detail. Then what? Regular alarms start going off all over the place for no sensible reason. A gun fires of its own accord and a man is shot. And a broken down old harness for no good for anything but chasing kids has to trip over us. Blind accident. What can you do against blind accidents? One thing I ought to have figured and didn't was Emmerich. I know why I didn't. I'm not kidding myself. It was the extra dough he promised. I got hungry. Greed made me blind.
Dix, isn't he the one with the reward on him?
Mind your own business.
Dix wipes blood off Doc's face, now in Commissioner Hardy's office.
She confirmed what Emmerich said, that he was with her from 11:30 till 3.
How did she impress you?
Very much. She's some babe.
That's not what I mean. Was her manner straightforward?
Oh, well, I guess she was telling the truth, all right.
Married 20 years, consorting with a woman young enough to be his granddaughter is disgusting. But nothing about Emmerich would surprise me. An educated man who uses his brains to circumvent the law. Worst type of human being. No excuse for him.
Excuse me, Commissioner.
Well?
There's a taxi driver been waiting outside. Says he's got some important information.
Concerning what?
I tried to find out, but he wouldn't talk to anyone but you. He's been waiting 2 hours.
All right, send him in.
Yes, sir.
Detective Andrews watches as the officer lets in the taxi driver.
What's your name?
Charles Wright, hacking number 14803, Green Stripe Company.
What's this information you got?
The little doctor everybody's looking for. I think I had him for a fare.
You drove him someplace?
Well, now, I'm pretty sure it was him I picked up at the station a week ago Friday.
Hardy's eyes shift.
Friday the 16th?
Yes, sir.
Where'd you take him?
To a number on Camden West. I remember because I asked him if he wanted me to wait. I know a fellow that got rolled once on Camden West, and he didn't have nothing, so they stole his pants and shoes.
Where did you take him? What number?
The driver pulls a notepad from his pocket.
4717. Kind of a storeroom. It was dark.
What's that number again?
4717.
Used to be a bookie joint, Commissioner.
Hardy leans to an intercom.
Get hold of Lieutenant Dietrich.
The commissioner hands the driver a file. His eyes widen and he smiles.
Yeah, that's him. At first I thought I was making a fool of myself by coming down here. But that's him all right, Commissioner.
You may be in for a reward, I hope so.
Lieutenant Dietrich, on run.
Hardy picks up the phone.
Where are you, Dietrich?
At the 4th Street Station, Commissioner.
All right. Now get a search warrant and go to 4717 Camden West. Friedenschneider was seen there.
Is that 4717?
Yeah. Take your men out before you go in. Get a move on.
Janicek.
Some news just came in. One of our patrolmen was on special duty at the car barn. He ran into two men and was slugged. They got away, but he identified the smaller one as Riedenschneider.
Good, great. We'll block off the whole area. No sirens. We'll make it a sneak. How about the patrolman? Badly hurt?
Oh, a head wound, and he's kind of punchy, but the doctor doesn't think he's got a fracture.
Well, son, looks like maybe we're getting somewhere at last.
At Cobby's.
Look, Lieutenant, what would I know about Belletiers? I wouldn't mix an old robbery, you know that.
Wouldn't you?
No, of course not. You saw Riedenschneider here, sure. That don't say...
You're nuts. Never seen anybody here. How could I? I've never been here before this.
Cobby pours some whiskey.
That being the case, what's to connect me with the Belletier job?
Somebody's on here. I don't know who. Maybe you got a finger on.
Cobby offers Dietrich a glass.
Look, you sure you won't have one, Lieutenant?
No, thanks. I never drink while on duty. It's against regulations.
Look, I got nothing to hide. Riedenschneider hold up. He was broke. I let him use one of the upstairs rooms for a couple of days. I got tired of having around. I gave him a few bucks. Get rid of him.
Where'd he go?
I don't know. I don't know.
Look, Cobby, do you figure me for a pal or don't you?
I sure do, Lieutenant.
Then take my advice and turn states. We'll make ourselves a little deal with the commissioner. You won't get more than a year or two.
Look, I'm clean. I don't know where the doc went. That's the truth.
They won't believe you at headquarters, Cobby. Every time you tell them that, they'd work you over. And you ain't the type that can take it. Believe me, you'd spill your guts in half an hour.
Sweat beads on Cobby's forehead. He clenches his hands and leans in to Dietrich.
Give me a break. You came to make a pinch, sure, but I'm not here. I had to go to Cheyenne business.
You're right here, Cobby.
I've always treated you right, Lieutenant. Let me duck out. You can get away with that.
No, I couldn't. The commissioner's mad. He's out for blood. And it's not going to be mine.
Cobby stands up straight.
You're not going to stop me. You're going to let me go. You're going to do that. If you don't.
Yeah, I know. You'll be a grade A pigeon.
That's right. I'll tell him you saw Reed and Schneider here. It didn't rouse them. Why? Because you'd have to explain what you were doing here. I'll tell him all about the juice you've been getting out of me.
Cobby, the only thing you're doing is making me sore.
Once I start singing, I won't stop. They'll drug you right alongside of me.
That's where you're wrong, Cobby. Even if they believe you, it won't go too hard with me. Because I'll be the guy that cracked the biggest case ever pulled in the country.
Cobby goes for the door and Dietrich swings.
Get hurt, Cobby!
Dietrich, what are you going, crazy?
Stand up!
The lieutenant holds Cobby by the collar and backhands him. Holding him at arm's length, Dietrich slaps him over and over, backing him into a table. Cobby collapses, sobbing into the crook of Dietrich's arm. The lieutenant shoves him off into a chair and pours a glass of whiskey.
I told you you couldn't take it, Cobby. Yeah.
Dietrich shoves the glass under Cobby's nose and he gulps it down.
Oh, call me fake.
That's my boy.
Dietrich pats him on the cheek and Cobby breaks down. Now at Emmerich's cottage.
So, since I'm going to be busy with a lot of cases, I thought you might like to take a trip.
Where to?
Oh, I don't know. The coast, Florida, anywhere you like.
Could I, Uncle Lon? Anywhere? No fooling?
Yes, I think a change of scenery might be good for you.
Wait. You wait right here. I've got the most terrific idea.
In a black cocktail dress, Angela runs to a dresser and retrieves a magazine. She flips through it as she hurries back to Emmerich and plops down next to him on the couch.
Oh, Cuba, that's not a bad idea.
Imagine me on this beach here in my green bathing suit. Yipe. I almost fought a white one the other day, but it wasn't quite extreme enough. I mean, don't get me wrong. If I really went in for the extreme extreme, I would have bought a French one. Run for your lives, girls. The fleet's in. Oh, Uncle Lon, am I excited? Yipe!
She shows him an ad.
Look, Uncle Lon, isn't it romantic? Real palms and ocean and everything.
She frowns at the door.
Can that be this time of night? See who it is, Uncle Lon.
He calmly puffs a cigarette and Angela's eyes widen.
Why are they pounding so? I'm scared, Uncle Lon.
Emmerich gets up and answers the front door. Andrews and Janicek stand with Hardy and two uniformed officers.
Well, young man, you've got an iron fist. Oh, hello, Hardy. Come in.
The commissioner and detectives enter. As the officers start forward, Emmerich closes the door and points to the living room.
Well, there's a fire in here. Come on in. You look cold.
Angela ducks out of the room as Hardy and the others enter. The commissioner drops his hat on the table and faces the fireplace. The detectives walk in and wait behind Emmerich.
I'm here to arrest you, Emmerich.
He shoots a glance at the detectives, then turns nonchalantly back to Hardy.
May I ask what for?
Complicity in robbery and in murder.
If I were you, Hardy, I'd think up a few more charges. You might be able to make one of them stand up if you get an imbecile jury and the right judge.
Get the young lady.
Yes, sir.
Andrews leaves. Hardy reaches into his inside coat pocket.
It may interest you to know that your friend Cobb has signed a confession. Want to take a look at it? Yeah.
Hardy hands him the confession. Emmerich unfolds the pages and sits to examine them. Down the hall, Andrews knocks on a bedroom door.
Okay, miss. It's a shame to bust this door in, but here goes.
Haven't you bothered me enough, you big banana head? Just try breaking my door, and Mr. Emmerich will throw you out of the house.
Afraid not, miss. He's got troubles enough. As a matter of fact, he's a dead duck.
Hurry up, Andrews. Bring the young lady in here.
Angela cringes.
Do I have to talk to him? Couldn't I just talk to you?
She gives him a pouty look.
Come on, baby. Get it over with. And be smart. Tell the commissioner the truth. That's the only thing to do. Come on.
Now, Angela walks back into the living room, followed by Andrews. Emmerich casually looks up from the confession as she walks past him to Hardy.
Sit down. Andrews, repeat the statement Miss Finley made before you and Officer Hannigan yesterday afternoon.
She said Mr. Emmerich was here in this house with her from 11:30 p.m. to 3 a.m. last Friday night.
Is that the statement you made?
Yes, sir.
Was it the truth?
Angela fearfully looks from Hardy to Emmerich. He keeps his gaze on the confession and flips to another page.
You better think before you answer, young lady, unless you want to go to jail.
Jail?
That's what happens to one who sets up a false alibi to keep another from being punished for a crime.
Mr. Emmerich wouldn't commit a crime.
He would and did.
She looks uncertainly at Emmerich, who nods.
Tell him the truth.
Uncle Lon.
It's the only thing to do, unless you want to be indicted for obstructing justice.
What I said yesterday was... Well, it wasn't exactly... I mean... It wasn't really the...
Was it the truth?
No, sir.
You went with Emmerich, were you?
No, sir.
You were someplace else and you were not with him.
Yes, sir.
He told you exactly what to say, made you learn it by heart.
Angela hides her face in her hands.
Answer me.
She shakes her head.
I mean, yes, sir. I mean, I learned it by heart.
Emmerich coldly watches her sob.
Get a new statement from her and have her sign.
Yes, sir.
And this time, young lady, I want the whole truth.
Over here, miss.
She stands, flipping her shiny blonde hair out of her face. She starts away and pauses to take Emmerich's hand.
I'm sorry, Uncle Lon. I tried.
You did pretty well, considering.
Angela holds onto his finger as she struggles to speak.
What about my trip, Uncle Lon? Is it still on?
Don't worry, baby. You'll have plenty of trips.
She smiles and Andrews leads Angela away. Hardy faces the fireplace.
Seems to be all wrapped up, Emmerich.
Emmerich stands and gives the confession back.
Oh, here. See, I'd like to telephone my wife, if you don't mind. Getting late, she might be worried.
Help yourself. But don't try to run. You won't get very far.
Emmerich stares at him for a moment, gives a slight smile, then exits. Janacek follows him out, staying a few steps behind. Emmerich walks into a study and takes a seat at the desk. A shaded table lamp casts a muted glow on the wall. On the desk next to the phone, a stack of notepaper rests in a holder. As the detective watches him from the hall, Emmerich takes a slip of paper from the stack and picks up a fountain pen. His brow furrows as he scribbles a letter in looping cursive. It reads, "Dearest May, forgive me. I cannot bear to face what I have done to you. I..." He pauses, the tip of the fountain pen hovering above the paper. Emmerich sets the pen aside and folds the paper in half. As he rips it into tiny pieces, a sad expression forms on his wrinkled face. He reaches into a desk drawer, and a shadow passes over the shredded letter.
Emmerich!
A gust passes over the scraps of paper. Now two officers escort Gus into a jail. As they walk him down the hall, Gus notices Cobby in the second cell. He turns his back to Cobby. As the officers open another cell, Gus lunges for Cobby through the bars and grabs him by the neck, pressing Cobby's head against the bars. The officers struggle to pull him off. Now, two detectives and an officer approach an apartment with guns drawn.
Fire escape.
One detective nods and moves aside as the other kicks open the apartment door. A young priest comes to the open door.
We're looking for Louis Chiavelli.
The priest looks over his shoulder. Inside, several mourners sit and Maria kneels before a coffin.
I'd consider it a great favor if you didn't insist on going in. Mrs. Chiavelli is, well, I don't have to tell you.
The father says it's okay, Williams. It's okay.
Call the commissioner's office. The commissioner knows me. Mention my name. Sortino.
At Dahl's.
Emmerich was a graduate of the Law College of State University and had practiced here for over 25 years.
What foolishness. Unbelievable. He wouldn't have got more than 2 years.
He even double-crossed himself. How's your head, Doc?
Good as it ever was, which isn't saying much.
You know, getting out of town is not going to be a cinch for you with your picture spread around.
Oh, I'll get out all right. I'll take a taxi to the edge of town and then have him drive me as far as Cleveland.
Dahl admires a gem.
Sure you wouldn't come along with me, Dix? Keep it.
Dahl sets it down.
No, thank you.
If you won't come with me, will you finance me? I haven't got but $4 or $5.
Sure, I'll finance you. How much you need?
I can get along on $1,000. Thanks very much. And you can have the rest of these stones. That's $50,000 for it.
What would I do with them? Can you see me walking into a hawk shop with that stuff? First they think they're a phony, and then they yell for the riot squad. Now, Doc, you can have the $1,000, but no rocks for me.
As Doc puts on his gem-filled coat, Dix passes him some bills.
Tell me where to write you. At least I can send you the $5,000 you got coming. What will your address be in Kentucky?
Forget it. Maybe I'll see you around.
He puts on his hat and they shake hands.
Goodbye, then.
Goodbye, Doc. Hey, wait a minute. You haven't got a heater. I'd let you have mine, but you got a gun, doll?
No, Dix. I used to have one around, but I guess somebody stole it.
I don't want a gun, thank you. I haven't carried a gun since my 20s. You carry a gun, you shoot a policeman. A bad rap, hard to beat. You don't carry a gun, you give up when they hold one on you.
All right, Doc, you know best.
Doc clicks his heels and gives a sharp nod to Dahl, then turns to the door and strolls out. Dix leans his head out the door, watches him go, then shuts the door. He smiles to himself, and Dahl's face brightens.
How about a cup of coffee, honey?
That squarehead, he's a funny little guy. I don't get him at all.
Well, maybe it's because he's a foreigner. They just don't think like us.
I gotta get out of town, too, and before morning.
Dix watches Doc out the window.
Anyway, he's got plenty of guts.
Dix flinches, holding his side.
How about a cup of coffee, honey?
Make it or shut up about it.
It's that wound.
Bright girl.
Dix, it's starting to bleed again. I know aspirin.
Dix looks at the small red spot forming on his shirt. Elsewhere, Doc paces out of a dark alley. He turns the corner and walks straight past two police officers at a call box to a cab. The round-faced cabbie watches him get in.
Pickering Avenue is interstate. You know where that is?
The other side of town.
How far is that?
Oh, I can make it in an hour.
Okay, I got relatives living there. I'm between trains and I got nothing else to do.
Doc squints at the cabbie's license, Frank Schurz.
On both sides. Always writing me letters for money.
Ah, sie haben Verwandten in Deutschland.
Ach, yeah. Sie sprechen gut Deutsch.
I haven't spoken German for a long, long time.
You have a München accent.
Not really. I was born there. But you know what they say. Home is where the money is.
Yeah.
Franz, how would you like to drive me to Cleveland?
It's a long way, my friend.
But it would still be quicker than to take the train tomorrow morning.
What about your relatives?
Ah, forget them.
Well, I don't know. Cleveland, that's a long way. Costs a lot of money.
There's a $50 tip for you. What do you say?
For $50, I'd drive you to the North Pole.
He takes the bill.
Well, we better get some gas if we're going to Cleveland.
Let's not stop here. Wait till we get out of town. Then we can do everything at once. Have a little meal, beer, cigar, and go in comfort.
I can see you're a man who likes his pleasures.
Well, Franz, what else is there in life, I ask you?
He offers the cabbie a cigar.
Bitter.
Back at Dahl's apartment, Dix paces, holding his side. He opens the door and Dahl rushes in.
You've been gone nearly 2 hours. What happened?
It took time. I was stopped twice, prowl cars. The neighborhood's crawling with coppers. Dix, you can't imagine.
All right, did you get a car?
Yes. Here's the change. It only came to $400. I got it from Big Vivian. It's in pretty good shape, Dix, except the brakes need
relining. Did you put gas in it?
Yes.
Where'd you park it?
3 blocks away.
Good girl.
Dix, he pulls his coat up his limp arm.
I'm scared. All those cops out there.
They don't worry me one little bit. I'll drive slow. Head right down to Main Boulevard, and in 10 hours, I'll be home.
Dix, honey, how are you going to drive all that way?
I'll make it.
No, not in the shape you're in, not in a million years.
I'll make it.
Dix, let me go with you. Please, Dix, please.
Are you crazy? I'm on the lam. I'm wanted bad, packing heat. If there's any trouble, what good would you be?
I could drive.
She stares at him closely.
No, doll. I'm wanted on a killing rap. You know what that means.
I don't care. I just want to be with you.
As he scowls down at her, she turns her back.
You can't go without me. I won't let you. I won't tell you where the car is.
Dix shakes his head.
I don't get it. I just don't get it. All right, kid, get your things packed.
She smiles up at him and dashes into the bedroom. Now at a diner, Doc sits at a counter and watches a tall boy and young girl dance. The young girl smiles brightly as they dance arm in arm. Entranced, Doc's eyes follow the young couple across the room. A shorter teen slouches in a chair with two half-empty soda glasses in front of him. The tall teen twirls the girl under his arm twice as the music stops.
Come on, let's play some more.
Gee, I'm fresh out of nickels, Jeannie. How about you, Red?
I'm always fresh out.
Well, get some.
You know, you can cost a guy a lot of dough.
Nickels he's complaining about. What a spender. Sure he wants a date. He always wants a date. And where do we go? To
to a third-run movie. Then we take a ride and blow two tires. Then we come in here, and what do you treat me to? Cokes. And I can't even listen to records.
That's for you. Thanks. Would you have change for this, Nichols, please?
Sure thing.
At least you can dig down far enough to play me some music.
Oh, Jeannie, cut it out. Excuse me, boys. Young lady, I like music, too.
Doc breaks a roll of nickels open on the table.
Will you play me a tune?
I sure will. What do you want me to play?
You pick him.
Gosh, how many have you got here?
Not very many. Play what you like.
Okay.
As Jeannie takes a nickel to the jukebox and makes her selection, Doc sits at the boys' table. The two teenage boys swap a glance as Jeannie starts to dance. She motions for the shorter boy to join her, and he takes her hands. She twirls under his arm, then twirls back as Doc watches her closely. Now Jeannie motions the teen away and continues on alone. She makes long claps, then holds her hands high over her head and swivels her hips forward. She wiggles her hips close to Doc, then bends over and claps away. As she snaps her fingers and spins, Doc keeps his gaze focused on her. Jeannie waves circles in front of her, then slides forward, snapping her fingers. She smiles, open mouth, and dances away again with hands held high. Outside, two police officers watch through the window behind her. The cabbie gets up from the counter and steps behind Doc. He taps Doc on the shoulder.
Mister, it's getting late.
Doc stares at the girl, entranced.
Mister, we better be moving along. Plenty of time, my friend. Plenty of time.
The young girl snaps in the air as she dances. The cabbie checks his watch.
Look, mister, it's a long way to Cleveland.
Jeannie spins and curtsies with a shrug as the song ends.
Well, I suppose we better go now.
Don't go. We haven't used all the nickels.
You use them.
Well, thanks. It's sure nice of you.
Don't mention it.
Goodbye, and thanks. Thanks ever so much.
Pleasure was all mine.
As Doc follows the cabbie out, he casts a longing look at Jeannie. Outside, an officer steps from the shadows as Doc exits. The officer draws his gun and follows a few feet behind. Gazing in the diner window, Doc pulls on his gloves as he strolls to the cab. The other officer steps up and walks next to Doc. Doc faces the policeman.
You men bond something?
What do you think, Ed?
Might be the number one boy. Just might be.
Say, what is this?
Shut up.
Better frisk.
Doc hands the cabbie his coat.
Hands.
You must have me mixed up with somebody else. I'm from Cleveland, the importing business. My name's Clemper.
Nothing there. Let me see that coat, Hackett.
Hey, you're making a
Shut
big
up.
Mistake.
Keep out of this.
Tell you what, Bill. Better phone the city and check in the description.
He pats the coat and feels the jewel sewn in the lining.
We don't need a description. I'll tell him we got him.
The officer with the coat walks off as the other holds his gun on Doc.
Okay, mister. Keep those hands up.
Of course. Excuse me, officer, but will you tell me something?
Maybe. Just keep your face front.
How long have you been out here?
That's a darn funny question.
It's not important.
We've been watching you through that window 2-3 minutes.
Ah, yes. Say about as long as it takes to play a phonograph record.
How's that again? What are you talking about?
It doesn't matter.
Well, keep your face front.
Do you mind if I smoke a cigar?
Just stand quiet there, mister. We'll talk about smoking a cigar later.
Certainly, officer. Certainly.
Now, a flashing pendulum swings at a railroad crossing. In a car, Dahl leans to Dix.
How are you feeling now, Dick?
All right. Cold. Didn't used to get cold this time of year.
Dix groggily watches the train cars speed by as they wait.
Why don't you let me drive for a while,
huh? You don't know the way. I'd only have to keep telling you.
He slumps forward.
Much longer, Dick.
She pushes him off her shoulder and gets out of the car. The headlights illuminate the passing train cars, and Dahl runs around through the beams to the driver's side. As she gets behind the wheel, Dahl leans Dick's back against the seat and cups his face in her hands. As the last car of the train speeds by in a cloud of steam, Dahl puts the car in gear. She pulls ahead into the darkness with Dick's leaning on her shoulder. Tears glisten on her cheeks. A rail worker smoking a pipe comes to the passenger window.
Mister, you gotta help me. I gotta find a doctor. My husband, he's sick.
Come on, I'll show you. Go straight on, ma'am, down at the end of the block. We'll get Doc Swanson. He lives right near here on Elm Street.
Dahl pulls ahead with the man riding on the car door. Later, they stand on a dark front porch holding up Dick's. Dahl runs off the porch and looks to an upstairs window. A light turns on. She hurries back to the door and takes Dix's other arm. A man in a striped bathrobe answers the door.
My husband, he's sick, Satan.
Inside here, Red. Look at him. Right in this other room here, please.
The man and Dr. Swanson carry him into an examination room.
Up on the table. Take his coat off.
Dahl sets his coat aside as the two men lay Dix onto the examination table. Swanson slides out an extension for his legs, then reaches into a doctor's bag on the counter. He places a stethoscope in his ears and opens Dix's shirt. He listens for a moment and checks the pulse on Dix's wrist. Swanson notices the bloody wound on Dix's side.
This man's been hemorrhaging. He's lost a lot of blood. What happened?
He was hurt. He was hurt in an auto accident.
How long has this wound been let go?
A couple of days. It's bad, doctor. Is he hurt real bad?
It's not good.
He braces Dix's arm and grabs an IV bottle.
You got a good strong arm, Mr. Atkinson?
Good as any, Doc, I guess.
Come around here and hold this for me, please.
Atkinson takes the glass bottle and holds it above his shoulder. Swanson inserts the rubber IV tube into Dix's arm.
There we are.
As the doctor walks out, Dahl stands over Dix. In the next room, Swanson sits at a desk holding a phone.
Hello, let me talk to Tom. This is Dr. Swanson. Well, wake him up.
Dahl's eyes glisten as Dix comes to.
I'm thirsty. Get me a drink of water.
Oh, sure, Dick, sure. Lie down, sweetheart. Please lie down.
Atkinson's eyes shift.
Hello, Sheriff. Listen, Tom. I got a man here with a gunshot wound. Pretty bad.
Yes, sweetheart.
Who's that?
I had to take you to the doctor's, Dick. I couldn't help it.
Hold him. I don't have to. The man's unconscious.
No. He's a stranger to me. His wife's with him. She says it was an auto accident.
Dix pulls out the IV.
Dick.
He sits up sluggishly, then stumbles out of the room.
Dick!
Dahl follows him outside. She grabs his arm as he lurches up to their black sedan. Swanson and Atkinson hurry to the porch as they pull away.
Well, he won't get very far, that's for sure. He hasn't got enough blood left in him to keep a chicken alive.
Now in Hardy's office.
Any more questions?
I don't like to harp on the same point, Commissioner, but what about Dietrich? The past of this police department...
Lieutenant Dietrich's in jail and he'll go to trial. He'll be tried by 12 citizens, the people for whom he's been working. Let them show justice or compassion as they see fit.
What would be your verdict, Commissioner?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure at all. Let me put it this way. It's not anything strange that there are corrupt officers in police departments. The dirt they're trying to clean up is bound to rub off on some of them, but not all of them. Maybe 1 out of 100. The other 99 are honest men trying to do an honest job.
He switches on a radio for the reporters.
Robbery at 193 Scully Avenue. All units, robbery at 193 Scully Avenue.
Two male Caucasians, armed with blue steel.
I know you're police reporters and you hear this all day long, but I want you to listen to your conscience, not just your ears.
As Hardy switches on another speaker, a photographer takes his picture.
Car 1-2, shooting at 2-5, James Boulevard, woman...
All units, strong-arm slugging, 3216 River Drive.
We send police assistance to every one of those calls, because they're not just code numbers on a radio beam, they're cries for help. People are being cheated, robbed, murdered, raped. That goes on 24 hours a day, every day in the year. And that's not exceptional, that's usual. It's the same in every city of the modern world. But suppose we had no police force, good or bad. Suppose we had...
He switches off the four speakers.
Just silence. Nobody to listen, nobody to answer. The battle's finished. The jungle wins. The predatory beasts take over. Think about it.
He sits at his desk.
Well, gentlemen, three men are in jail, three men dead, one by his own hand, one man's a fugitive. We have reason to believe seriously wounded. That's 6 out of 7, not bad. And we'll get the last one, too. In some ways, he's the most dangerous of them all. A hardened killer. A hooligan. A man without human feeling or human mercy.
Morning. A road curves off of a metal bridge and out of a forested countryside. The black sedan speeds along as the road continues on between vast horse pastures. A dozen horses graze in the early morning sun. White split rail fences line the road on both sides. In the car, Dix drives with a far-off look and Dahl's tear-streaked face trembles. The car crests a hill and continues toward even more pastures. Dix stares ahead, dazed.
tell you, the black one's the best we ever had at Hickory. The bay's all right, but the black's a real good call. Prettiest way of going to anything, Bob or Brad. Easiest thank you, but he's always way out front. The other yearlings. He's a stake horse, I never saw one. I sure hope Pa don't sell it.
Now stone fences line the roads as they speed past a house.
Pa just hangs onto that black pool. Everything's gonna be all right.
Thank God.
I said it. I'll say it again. If Pa just hangs onto that black coal, everything's gonna be okay.
As they pass the stone fence driveway, the sedan pulls off the road to a stop. Dix pushes the door open and staggers out.
What's it?
Dahl follows him out of the car as Dix unlatches a wooden fence. A large red bloodstain soaks his shirt. A sign on the fence reads, Hickory Wood Farm. Dix pushes past a smaller pasture gate into a field and Dahl hurries after. Dix makes lanky strides into the pasture, with Dahl running a few yards behind him. He stumbles through the field under a cloud-filled sky. The top of a farmhouse juts from a glade in the distance, and some horses graze nearby.
Oh, Dix!
Dix collapses in the middle of the pasture. Dahl runs over to him and rolls him onto his back.
Dix, Dix. Oh, God, Dix, Dix.
Dahl runs off toward the distant farmhouse. Two horses and then a third trot over to Dix's body and begin to graze beside him. Dix lies motionless, open-mouthed, and lifelessly staring skyward. One horse bumps him with its nose as it eats. Now four horses graze around his limp body and words appear. The end. Made in Hollywood, USA by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Credits. Sterling Hayden as Dix Handley. Louis Calhern as Alonzo D. Emmerich. Gene Hagen as Dahl Conovan. James Whitmore as Gus Manisi. Sam Jaffe as Doc Irwin Riedenschneider. John McIntyre as Police Commissioner Hardy. Mark Lawrence as Cobby. Barry Kelly as Lieutenant Dietrich. Anthony Caruso as Louis Chiavelli. Teresa Celli as Maria Chiavelli. Marilyn Monroe as Angela Finlay. William Davis as Timmons. Dorothy Tree as Mae Emmerich. Brad Dexter as Bob Branham. John Maxwell as Dr. Swanson.